Welcome one and all to another episode here at the Damage Report with me, John Arola, and we're joined by a very special guest, once again, David Schuster. David, how's it going?
Hello, John. Good to be with you and the Dragon Squad. We got a lot of fun stuff coming up today.
Great to have you here. The squad loves to have some rebels join us because, of course, David's of Rebel HQ doing amazingly over there. What are some of the topics you've covered recently over at the HQ?
I just put together a 7-minute video on Lauren Boebert. I was, you know, for many years I thought that Louis Gohmert was the stupidest member of Congress, but after going through all the tapes and all the reels, Lauren Boebert by far is the dumbest and the most ignorant, and we explain in 7 minutes on today's video, so everybody should check it out.
That is a fascinating question. Obviously, we have way more experience with Louis Gohmert, and Louis Gohmert has said some really dumb stuff. But Lauren, it's definitely a different flavor of stupid. Louis Gohmert is more of that sort of folksy, I kind of get on some level that I'm dumb. Right. Whereas Lauren Boebert's very like sassy, I totally am not aware that I'm coming up short here. So I don't know, maybe we could do a poll on Twitch.
Well, what did it for me was Lauren Boebert said just a couple of days ago to Mike Huckabee, she compared herself to Jesus Christ about whether or not she should tone it down. She says, well, Jesus didn't tone it down. I'm thinking, well, if you're really going to compare yourself to Jesus, maybe there's some other things about Jesus that she ought to know. So anyway, it's a fun video.
Yeah, no, that's the only one, is that he didn't tone it down. He's basically the Joe Rogan of his time. He was just having open, fun conversations. She also said on Twitter that the Constitution never evolves, which anyway. I do think though, David, look, I'm obviously a big fan of yours, but I will not stand for this Marjorie Greene erasure. If we're going to do this poll, you need to be fair.
Well, it's one of these things where one of them takes the lead for a couple of days, and then the other one says something or tweets something, and then takes the lead back. So at least for now, until Marjorie Taylor Greene opens her mouth again or tweets something, for now, Lauren Boebert is the dumbest member of Congress.
Sure.
But that may not last.
That's true, true. And of course, we can't forget that Donald Trump has said a lot of really stupid stuff in his life as well. There's a lot of competition on that. But in any event, thank you for joining us.
Of course.
That goes out to you, David, of course, but also the audience, thank you for being here. We've got a lot that we're going to be talking about through the course of the next 90 minutes. Not only the old crow claiming his nickname and attacking Donald Trump, what's coming from the Cuomo brothers? We've got some updates there, infiltration of the progressive movement, as well as you thought, John, it was already kind of weird how much you were talking about postal trucks and how passionate you got about it, but we've actually got maybe even worse information coming this time. So all of that is coming up, as well as we are regrettably limited to only 1 hour of David today. But that means there's still like 25, 30 minutes of the show. So we've got a special little treat planned for you, maybe a little guest. We'll see. Okay, Brooke is asking about the poll on Twitch. I would like it if you were paying attention. So thank you. I don't know if you were on, I don't know if she was on or if she's, because there's a lot of chat going on. Anyway, we will see. Maybe people in the chat can fill her in. But with all that said, if you wouldn't mind hitting the like button and sharing the stream, that would be great. And David, with that said, would you like to jump into some news?
You know what? I actually don't have it right in front of me. For some reason, I thought you were gonna lead.
Okay, I will, I guess. Okay.
Okay.
With that said, I'll leave.
Well, let's talk. I tell you what. I'll suggest that. Let's talk about Mitch McConnell.
Okay. No, I'm actually ready to go with that. I think that's perfectly in our wheelhouse. So with that, let's jump into this.
Okay.
Well, let me give you my view of what happened January the 6th, and we're here. We're here. We saw what happened. It was a violent insurrection for the purpose of trying to prevent the peaceful transfer of power after a legitimately certified election from one administration to the next. That's what it was. With regard to the suggestion that the RNC should be in the business of picking and choosing Republicans who ought to be supported, traditionally the view of the National Party Committees is that we support all members of our party, regardless of their positions on some issues.
Do you have confidence in her, Ron McDaniel, as chairwoman of the committee?
I do, but the issue is whether or not the RNC should be sort of singling out members of our party who may have different views from the majority. That's not the job of the RNC.
Okay, so that is Mitch McConnell, leader of the Republicans in the Senate, responding to a couple of different things that have been going on in the GOP recently. Obviously, the censure of people like Representative Kinzinger and Cheney, but also the RNC coming out with that statement that, like, nah, January 6th was great, totally legitimate, it was the best. So he disagrees with those. So, David, how much credit do you give Mitch McConnell for these positions?
I don't think this is exactly a profile in courage, and it's the same thing that I think we saw with Mike Pence, who's one of the more conservative conservatives that are out there. The polling in the Republican Party has shifted dramatically over the last 6 months. Maybe it's because of the January 6th committee, all the revelations that have come out, all the revelations that are coming, but there's blood in the water surrounding Donald Trump. And if you go back to, say, October 2020, it was something like 55% of the Republicans identified first with Donald Trump and the party second. And it was like 35% identified first as Republicans. That's now flipped. Now it's only about 35% that identify first as with Donald Trump. 55% identify first with the Republican Party. Republican leaders see this. They see Donald Trump still having a very committed base, but a base that is getting smaller. And for Mitch McConnell, for Mike Pence, who wants to run for president, not having Donald Trump at the top of the party would be a godsend for them. And they finally see that they've got some political cover because of how people feel about Donald Trump to go ahead and distance themselves from the president. So I don't think that's certainly a profile in courage at all. Mitch McConnell is still going to hedge his bets, but he's certainly seeming more comfortable to distance himself from Donald Trump. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the change in the polls that you referenced there, I'd seen that too, and it's definitely interesting. I don't think it got as much recognition as I think it deserved, but it is coming at the end of a year which represented the least Donald Trump we've experienced for about half a decade. Do you think that that number could just as easily reverse itself once we get towards, you know, presidential campaign season and Donald Trump is suddenly popping up every single day?
You know what? I don't think so, for the simple reason that I have a feeling that the January 6th committee is going to dominate more of the headlines than Donald Trump can sort of drive the headlines. I mean, if you go back to Donald Trump's first campaign, of course, every time he would open his mouth and he had these incredibly engaging and sort of fun to watch, fun being the strange word, in terms of his rallies, and he could just sort of control the media and everybody gave him a lot of attention. Now the media is not giving him so much attention, but they are giving a lot of attention to what the January 6th committee is doing. And the committee is likely going to have subpoenas for Ivanka Trump, for Sean Hannity. There's all sorts of indications now that Donald Trump was far more involved in organizing and planning and encouraging people to storm the Capitol. And as that starts to come out, as that narrative starts to be sort of occupy the media space, I think a lot of Republicans, they want to just move on from January 6th, whether they feel it was justified or not. They don't want to talk about it. And the more that it is talked about and Donald Trump is associated with it, I think that causes Donald Trump's numbers to sort of further go down. Again, it doesn't eliminate Donald Trump, but I think it provides some cover for a lot of Republicans.
Yeah, and maybe that's as simple as it is, that Mitch McConnell feels a little bit freed up to identify it for what it actually is. It was a violent insurrection. You know, I know it was one of the idiots on the right was coming out today. It was like, no, you can't call it that because it had no chance of succeeding. Okay, well, you know, we're not responsible for the fact that they're incompetent and that their eyes are bigger than their stomachs. Like, okay, you failed. You still wanted to do it. Attempted murder is still bad. I'm not a lawyer, but I believe that's basically how it works.
Well, Mitch McConnell also sees that he doesn't want Senate Republicans to get murdered politically. And he's looking at, well, he might be able to pick up enough seats to be able to become the Senate Majority Leader again. But the polling also suggests that to the extent that the political world is focused on Donald Trump and not focused on the Democrats, Republicans want voters to think only about Joe Biden, think only about inflation, think about the things that Joe Biden has done wrong. Every time that Donald Trump enters the conversation, or look back at Donald Trump or January 6th enters the conversation, Republicans feel their possibility of taking control of both the House and the Senate starts to slip away. And that's another reason, you know, Mitch McConnell's also got some moderate Republicans, who are more centrist, who are not exactly Trump supporters, who are also up for re-election. He's trying to protect them as well.
Yeah. Although I do want to add to, you know, him being willing to identify that and saying, hey, let's not necessarily excommunicate our members, you know, just because they agreed with my assessment of what January 6th was. And by the way, that's basically what they've done. The censure resolution he was referring to there says that the RNC shall immediately cease any and all support to Cheney and Kinzinger. Says that they had crossed a line. Okay, well, so he's saying don't do that. But to be fair, while Mitch McConnell does identify January 6th as a violent insurrection, As Sophie pointed out in our production doc, there are a couple of additional facts about Mitch McConnell that you should probably take into account. One is that he's totally fine with all of the Republicans running for office agreeing with the same lies that led to January 6th. He's not saying we need to do a better job of weeding them out, or we need to be more supportive of primary challenges to Josh Hawley or Ted Cruz. I mean, they supported the insurrection. So with that, he still supports Donald Trump. Like, they're arguing or whatever. But if Donald Trump runs in 2024 and he's the nominee, McConnell is gonna support him. That is just very clear. And despite the fact that he identifies January 6th as having been an insurrection, he has no interest whatsoever in it being investigated. He didn't want the commission that you were just talking about to actually exist. So you're saying it was a violent insurrection, but none of your other actions seem like they would naturally follow from what you've identified. You seem pretty cool with it, even if you might identify it as an insurrection.
Well, and that raises the million-dollar question I'll pose to you, and that is, I mean, Mitch McConnell obviously wants to hedge his bets and protect himself just in case Donald Trump wins the nomination and, you know, wins the presidency again. Given the sort of war of words between Donald Trump and Mitch McConnell, do you think McConnell is hedging his bets successfully? Do you think that Donald Trump will forget about what he sees as Mitch McConnell crossing him right now, you know, 6 months, a year in the future?
It's an interesting question, but I think we should identify that, like, forgetting it doesn't function the same way for Trump as it does for other people. Mm-hmm. Like, first of all, I think he's gonna hate Mitch McConnell for the rest of his life, probably. But you say something nice about him, he loves you. You vote against him, he hates. Like, it flip-flops so quickly. Like, there's no relationship inertia that builds up. No, like, foundation. It's all, what was the last thing you did to me? Which is not how most people function. Most people, like, you're willing to cut them some slack based on your past relationship, or vice versa. So look, I think he's going to hate Mitch McConnell. In this case, even if Mitch McConnell delivers for him in terms of legislation in some future presidency. But I'm also not entirely sure how much it matters from Mitch McConnell's point of view, unless it leads to Donald Trump supporting someone else who would become majority leader in a future Republican majority, which I haven't heard much talk about that. Do you think that that's a consequence that Mitch McConnell should be worrying about?
No, and Mitch McConnell's got a much better control in terms of centrists have much more influence, of course, in the Senate than they do in the House. So I think Mitch McConnell doesn't fear that there's any sort of leadership challenge. John Cornyn, the Republican from Texas, is very loyal to him, not to Donald Trump. So I don't think McConnell sees that there are any Trumpsters like a Senator Johnson or somebody who would have enough support to be able to challenge him. I think where McConnell may be a little concerned is he also needs control of the House in order for his agenda in the Senate to get through. And he recognizes that there are a number of Republican districts where it takes a more moderate Republican or a centrist sort of candidate to be successful. And he doesn't want to block them off. He doesn't want them to be primaried by the Trumpsters, who then make it a more difficult battle in order to win the seat come November.
Yeah. I want to jump into something ridiculous for just a few minutes. Let's talk about this. For some time now, for some reason that no one can identify, Donald Trump has christened Mitch McConnell as the broken down old crow, which is, I believe, the literal last animal you would think of when looking on Mitch McConnell's face. But anyway, that's what he calls him. And Mitch McConnell has finally responded to that, saying, "It's my favorite bourbon." That's what he said on Tuesday evening in an interview with the Washington Examiner. He said, "Aren't we using old crow as my moniker now? It was Henry Clay's favorite bourbon." Clay represented Kentucky in the House and the Senate in the early to mid 1800s. And it is indeed an old bourbon. It wasn't one that I'm familiar with. It is Old Crow bourbon, which my producers helpfully identify you can get for $22. So I don't know, maybe this is Mitch McConnell trying to appear like a man of the people with his relatively cheap bourbon. Anyway, it's just, you never know as a politician, David, what you will end up getting labeled by Donald Trump. If you ended up being called the old crow, would you consider that getting off lightly?
Well, if it came from Donald Trump, I would think it didn't it has nothing to do with bourbon. It may have something to do with some sort of cartoon character. I think of maybe like the old Elmer Fudd, and I think there was sort of a crow-like figure who had sort of a strange neck and sort of hunched over like Mitch McConnell. I think that's what Donald Trump is actually referring to. I don't think he knows that the first thing about bourbon. And if that's his reference, then I would think, okay, a childhood cartoon from the 1960s or 70s, that would seem to sort of fit. Uh-huh. I would say, okay, that's just Donald Trump. He's been watching a lot of TV through his life, and that's all he knows. And he sees me or Mitch McConnell, whatever it is, looking like a crow. Hmm. Okay, yeah. It's a little pathetic, but whatever.
That's funny because I watched those cartoons growing up. I have no idea of what crow that is, but it does make sense that for two reasons that might be the reference that Trump is making. One is that his references would come from 60 years ago, and two, that it would be a cartoon that he would be referencing there. But in any event, I just want to remind people of one thing. I did not launch into this so that we could just talk about like, oh, is he an old crow? Like, no, he's awful actually. Whether you identify him as a crow or a turtle or a shriveled up old human being, remember he also liked being known as the Grim Reaper in a previous political era. So his thing there was, no, I am the person that is going to kill literally any effort by the government to help anyone who isn't a multi-millionaire. Doesn't matter what majority you get in the House or whatever, doesn't matter how any of these policies poll. It doesn't matter because we don't live in the government system that you might think that we do. I will kill it. And so he was labeled the Grim Reaper, and he was apparently quite happy about that at that time, David.
And look, I mean, Mitch McConnell, he doesn't have a lot of years left. It wouldn't surprise me if he, you know, if he can't become majority leader in 2022, I'm not so sure he lasts much beyond. I think he's up for re-election, what, in 2026, 2028? I don't think he's going to run for re-election. So I think this is it for him. One more shot at being Senate majority leader again, hopefully for his sake. He's hoping that the Republicans can take the House and then he can sort of impose his will on the American people as he has with more corporate tax cuts, more allowing government to essentially shrink, allowing big business to sort of run wild with pollution and garbage and everything else. And who cares about, you know, working class people? That's essentially, oh, and by the way, if you can throw in another conservative Supreme Court justice, that's also good for Mitch McConnell. That's the vision that he has of America. And I think he wants one more shot of having the Senate and the House to be able to do it. Or at least to stymie what Joe Biden is doing and hoping that he can somehow get another lunatic Republican in 2024 so that he can wreak more havoc across the United States and help himself and his cronies. But I don't think Mitch McConnell's in it for much longer than a few more years.
Yeah, I think that you might be right. And obviously from his point of view, I think he's accomplished a lot. He's, you know, made the government into even more of a mockery than it was. He's drained it of any of the money necessary to actually help working people. And he has gotten through multiple insane people on the Supreme Court. But I think you can always have more. You can always set your sights higher. I mean, putting Kavanaugh on, that was really reprehensible, and I'm sure he's quite proud of it. But I don't think he will rest until he can get someone on the Supreme Court who's accused of sexual assault, like while they're being considered for the Supreme Court, like mid-hearing. They should be accused of sexual assault. Then I think he could go to his grave peacefully.
Well, anyway. But that would be something else. Mitch McConnell feels like he's got enormous political skills, and it would, I suppose, be an incredible political feather in his own cap. Mm-hmm. And he would say, "Look how good I am at politics that I can get somebody through in the midst of a sexual harassment accusations during the hearing." And he would probably love that.
Let's hope that we don't end up there. That would be a feather in his cap that he could provide the old crow. Okay, let's dive into a little update of a couple characters we haven't talked about for some time.
Cuomo!
Wait, is that Kinziger? Is he involved? There we go, thank you. I don't know, maybe he's involved, who knows? News is Mad Libs, everybody. You just need to get used to it these days. Okay, with that. Over the last year, we saw two Cuomos go down for largely but not wholly unrelated scandals. So of course, Andrew Cuomo faced multiple allegations of sexual harassment, sexual assault, as well as scandals over, you know, sort of minimizing the number of deaths that were coming from places like nursing homes, those sorts of things. And then Chris Cuomo had his problems as well. And all of this we've covered in depth. They have both receded from public view over the past few months. That said, that might not be forever. So we're finding out now that some political operatives who've spoken with this is Andrew Cuomo on this side, or his aides say they think he's considering a run for attorney general this year against Miss Letitia James, who, by the way, he has dispatched allies of his to complain about her, to attack her, because of course she was involved in the investigation into the allegations against him. So I don't know, David, if that's going to happen, that run, but if it did, that is a very interesting circumstance to be going up against the person who is investigating you. We don't see that very often.
Yeah, a certain level of audacity there, but maybe we shouldn't be surprised, John. I mean, I work for a guy named Elliot Spitzer, the former governor of New York, who was client number 9 because of prostitution. And he had his career rehabilitated sort of because of, hey, CNN gave him a show. And then Crunchy V did as well. But then he decided, oh, I'm going to run for, I guess it was mayor, and that didn't go so well. So there's something in the water in which people of New York feel like, okay, they get humiliated, they almost perhaps get indicted. And they think, well, if I just lay low for a little while, then I can resurface, restart my media career, restart my political career, and everything's going to be fine. I don't think it's going to work for Andrew Cuomo because I don't think he's got the kind of support across the Democratic Party that he thinks he does, but I'm sure he'll try.
You mean there, you're referring there to institutional support?
Yeah, institutional. I mean, there are a lot of Democrats that he infuriated over the last several years. A lot of people who that claim that he forgot them. There are a lot of people who feel like he stepped on some toes, that he was an abusive boss, that there are people who went to work for him who didn't have a good experience. I think all those stories are sort of still out there and will hang in the air pretty heavily against him. And so while he may think, oh yeah, I can just sort of waltz into a race for the Attorney General's office, I think there might be some financial people, some strategy people, some operatives who are not so keen to that because they've had friends and relatives who have worked for him who didn't have a very good experience.
Interesting. Okay. Well, I'm gonna give some of the evidence that might bolster his case a little bit, and then we can see what we think. So let's see. He spent more than $1 million from his campaign account since leaving office, which wasn't that long ago. He still has $16 million on hand, according to the State Board of Elections, which seems like a good amount of money for a run like that. Nearly $900,000 went to his lawyer, Mrs. Glavin, with additional outlays to his spokesperson's firm and for letters sent to voters, according to board records. So some of that money was spent subsidizing the people who were going out and spreading, reasons to question his accusers or James herself. And a poll from the Siena College Research Institute back in September found that New York Democrats believe that he should have resigned, 55% to 35%, but Democrats still rated him more favorably than unfavorably in September and October Siena polls, which by the way is not necessarily what we might have expected coming out of a scandal like that, but that also means he is way more accepted by his state's Democrats than Kyrsten Sinema is, and she hasn't resigned, she's still in office. So if the approval numbers are still looking good, how do you balance the party maybe having a bunch of issues with him and maybe being worried about having him and his issues be attached to them again, versus he's looking out there at the polls and the money he has, and maybe that is enough for him to think that he can make a run at it?
Oh yeah, I have no doubt that he thinks he can make a run, both between those money, between some of the people who are going to tell him, yeah, go for it. And you know what? He may think, even if I do have some of this baggage, even if he does have the self-awareness to realize that he has alienated a lot of people within the Democratic Party, he may think, so what? Sometimes it's not just Andrew Cuomo versus Andrew Cuomo. There's going to be a real opponent, whether it's James or anybody else. And sometimes you luck out because your opponent does not run a very strong campaign, or because the political winds change, or because circumstances. And the fact of the matter is, there still are people in New York who remember how Andrew Cuomo did at the beginning of the pandemic and made them feel safe, even if he made things worse for people in nursing homes. But so he still gets some credit, and he may think, hell, never mind, the Democratic institutions that may be aligned against me or the people who are saying bad things about me. I still have a base of support out there within the Democratic Party. I'm still popular. I have a lot of money. I don't care whether the institutional part of the Democratic Party is against me. I'm still going to run.
Yeah, maybe. Well, let's turn from one Cuomo to another. Chris Cuomo apparently has some plans for a possible return to, financial success, if not a career, but we can talk about those possibilities too. Multiple sources apparently are telling Page Six that Chris Cuomo is ready to dig in his heels by claiming that Zucker, former head of CNN, not only knew about his dealings with Andrew Cuomo, which was one part of the scandal that saw him stepping down, but that the network boss had his own inappropriate dealings with Andrew. He is prepared to demand not the $18 million that are currently left on his contract or were when he stepped down, but as much as $60 million. The source told Page Six he wants Megyn Kelly money. So I don't know, what do you make of that? Like, he did have a significant portion of his your contract still left to go. He apparently wants more money than that. What do you think the odds are of him getting that?
I don't think there are any odds at all of him getting that. Unless, I mean, from my own sort of dealings with network contracts and all that sort of thing, it's, and when contracts are not extended or they're cut short, it's hard to ask for more money than what is left on your contract, unless you suffered some sort of damages, they fired you improperly. Maybe he's now threatening, hey, I'm gonna file a wrongful termination lawsuit against all of you, which would be the balance of his contract plus damages. But I don't see how that gets to $60 million. I think this is just a negotiating ploy, if anything. And I would frankly be surprised if he even got the balance of the $18 million. Clearly, he violated CNN rules by advising his brother, by not fully disclosing the advice that he was given and how often he was in contact with his brother. And we can all say, sure, I would advise my brother as well. But yeah, if you're told you have to tell your employer about it, you have to do that. And he didn't do it. Now, CNN's also in a tough spot because of Jeff Zucker not disclosing his relationship when it began, and also because this largely flows out of the Cuomo investigation that Jeff Zucker got in some trouble. But I kind of separate those two. I think, yeah, Jeff Zucker's not coming back for sure. I don't think Chris Cuomo's going to get most of the money that he's looking for, but you know, he's going to try.
Yeah. Do you, just out of curiosity, I mean, we don't have a lot of information to go on in this, or at least I don't know publicly available information, but Chris Cuomo, in terms of like future ventures, do you see him ever, like Megyn Kelly, you know, like she had a few shows that she tried to do or whatever. Do you see Chris Cuomo getting a show again? Do you think he's gonna go like with an independent podcast or something? What do you think?
That's a great question, John. And I never thought that Megyn Kelly would get another show, but she did. She has her own sort of podcast or production company. I think Chris Cuomo, he burned some bridges at ABC News. I don't think he's going back there. I don't think he'll never go back to CNN because there are too many people at CNN who don't like him. I think he burned some bridges there. So a lot of people in the CNN world who are going to other places will not hire him. But Chris Cuomo's going to get enough money, or has enough money, that if he wanted to start his own production company, if he wanted to start his own online show, if he wanted production deals with Discovery or somebody like that, sure. I mean, I suppose he's a fine enough broadcaster and talent to be able to pull that off. I just don't see him ever having the kind of perch, the kind of profile that he had at CNN.
Yeah. Yeah. And like we've said, we do this literally every time. We like needlessly go out of our way to like talk about any potential bias. Chris Cuomo is one of the only people on mainstream media that has had TYT people on. Like he's, you know, I would not classify him as a massive progressive or anything, but he was one of the few who would actually bring on progressive guests from time to time. So we're just putting that out there. I believe we are accurately and fairly reporting on him, regardless of whatever potential bias you think me appearing on there a couple of years ago might provide. Final question, and this is obviously the most substantive one, David. You're considering Andrew and Chris as brothers. Chris was once sort of playfully lampooned by John Oliver for his Instagram activity, which would often see him in the gym. Do you think it bothers him that Cuomo sexual came about as a thing to refer to Andrew?
Well, that's gotta sting. You know, there was a lot of chatter when all the Andrew Cuomo sexual stuff came out, that it was only a matter of time, right, before Chris Cuomo had his own sort of issues. And there was a former network executive who said that Chris Cuomo was very inappropriate with her, and he apologized, all this sort of thing. But you know, Chris Cuomo has something of a reputation of being a ladies' man, even after he got married. So, you know, did he treat his exes, his mistresses, very well? I mean, sometimes, who knows? But yeah, I think, you know, I think he was a guy who liked the sort of the cachet of being known as a ladies' man. And sometimes that can come back to haunt you.
Yeah, yeah. It is a burden, I will say. Anyway, with that said, that's potentially the futures for them. We will see. Nobody really goes away in American politics. I mean, even Sarah Palin came back eventually. So just bear that in mind. Why don't we jump into slightly different news here? You remember Eric Prince? Under investigation by the Justice Department, formerly of Blackwater, involved in a whole bunch of real world awful stuff, and then a bunch of stuff which I am pretty sure is just a series of log lines for sort of quasi sci-fi, military, private, whatever, adventures abroad. Anyway, he also had some plans domestically to infiltrate different groups, including Democratic campaigns, progressive groups, and some Republicans not seen as sufficiently loyal to Donald Trump. So there's some great New York Times reporting on this that we want to tell you about. Obviously, more details are available to the New York Times if you'd like them. But they reported yesterday that Eric Prince helped former British spy Richard Seddon in his operation that sought to surveil liberal organizations, democratic operations, and individuals opposed to then President Trump in an effort to gather unfavorable information that could be used against politicians and activists across the country. They say that Prince became the operation's celebrity pitchman and fundraised for the spying effort. They say that the two said the goal of the private spying operation was to gather dirt both on Democrats and rhinos, slang in conservative circles for Republicans in name only. The plan was to begin in Wyoming, they said, and expand operations from there. And so there's some concerns around some campaign donations they made that in theory might violate federal campaign finance laws. But the idea was that they were going to either place or flip undercovers in these different places to develop attachments with individuals and organizations and then provide information back. And this was designed to hurt both sort of standard establishment Democrats, progressives in different activist organizations, and even Republican politicians as well. So it was a pretty broad operation, David.
I'm not surprised by the cloak and dagger nature of what Eric Prince would be involved in. I am a little bit surprised in that I'd heard that he was a fairly smart guy, and this sounds pretty stupid. I mean, what is it that you're afraid of in Wyoming? I mean, you really think that Wyoming is going to trend and become a democratic state like Colorado? No, of course not. Mm-hmm. So the lengths that he went, and by enlisting Project Veritas and some of the others, sure, that's the world that I suppose he lives in, and nobody should be surprised, but he would do all this sort of subterfuge and everything else. But what, again, I just can't figure out, you're that afraid of progressive groups, you're that afraid of Democrats making inroads in a place like Wyoming, you're that afraid of anti-Trump Republicans, and this is your way of dealing with your anxieties and fears? That's just weird. Am I wrong?
Yeah, the Wyoming thing is the weirdest thing. It's so weird to conceive of, oh my God, it's on the precipice of flipping blue or even purple, that it makes it seem as if it's got to have been a personal thing, right? Maybe not for Eric Prince, but for somebody involved in this, like to want to take down the governor, Mark Gordon. I feel like that had to have been a personal thing. I don't know. Maybe more reporting will come out. And look, of course, there are versions of this that are not necessarily as surprising or as reprehensible. I mean, everybody wants to get information, clearly. That's what a lot of reporting is based on. That's certainly, like, political dirt is not a new thing. There's just something about it being so, like, intentional and organized and well-funded and potentially long-term. It reminds me of, I'm not sure if you were familiar, a few weeks ago, there was that story about, I think it was an operative working with, like, British intelligence who had, like, lived a double life in British environmental organizations, even like doing long-term relationships with women who were activists in the movement while he was married, like as a spy. It just, there's something so dirty about it. Like, and I have to imagine that if you're in some of these states or if you're in one of these organizations, if you're reading this, you're probably looking around and wondering, like, am I 100% sure that I can trust all of these people, especially newer people, that maybe they're not just here to try to get information and trap us or whatever?
Well, that's a good point, because it sounds like this goes beyond just infiltration. I always figured with Project Veritas and some of the others, it wasn't just about humiliating what they described as the liberal media. They wanted to blackmail them. They wanted to have something on camera where they could go back to the organization and say, okay, pay us a lot of money or whatever it is. And I almost get the sense with Eric Prince that for him, it wasn't also just about infiltrating and gathering information, that maybe his way of operation is to gather terrible things about people and then go back to them and say, okay, now pay me off. That's how we're going to do business. Otherwise, I'm going to destroy you. And maybe you would destroy them anyway. There is a sort of a darker element, a shadier element when it goes that far. And it certainly seems to look that way because on the surface, it doesn't seem like this was just looking for information, just trying to understand why progressives were making the pitches that they were.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you're totally right. That's that layer that takes it beyond just normal politics. I do think that there's one other layer that we should identify, though, which is like all of that is reprehensible. But in theory, some of it you might think, well, you know, if the stuff is true, it's true. But as you point out, they're involving Project Veritas, which frequently lies and edits things incredibly deceptively, dishonestly. So it's almost one thing if it's just intelligence gathering, but if it's like deceiving people about the intelligence that you've gathered, that's even worse. It's just there's seemingly no end to the different ways that this is disgusting. It's a nasty, nasty parfait in that way.
And there's a silliness to Project Veritas with like their silly little nicknames they give each other. I guess this British spy in this particular case who worked for them was known as Kim Chi. Okay, was he Korean American, whatever? Fine. But it's almost like they enjoy playing this role of being like a 007 type of, you know, international agent who goes undercover. And that's just kind of sad.
Yeah. Yeah. You're not James Bond. You're trying to blackmail a Republican in Wyoming. That's not as cool as you think it is. There are worse lives. It's not great. Anyway, okay. So with that said, we are going to take our second break. But when we come back, you've all demanded it. We want John to talk about NFTs more. But no, we have a good reason. We're going to give you an update on the Melania Trump NFT story from like a month ago. How did that actually work out in practice? We have that and more. And then for the last half hour of the show, we do have a surprise. So there's lots to look forward to, but we'll see you after this. Okay. This last block that we have with David is like, it feels like so TDR, these two topics back to back. We're gonna be talking about NFT scams and postal vehicles. So anyway, but I think that there's some important stuff here. So with that said, let's launch into this. Not long ago, Melania Trump launched an NFT. Why not? Every rich person is doing it. It was expected to bring in about $170,000, maybe a little bit more, maybe as much as a quarter million. And for that, what do you get? Well, the artwork is called Melania's Vision, and we were told it embodies Melania Trump's cobalt blue eyes, providing the collector with an amulet to inspire. And that amulet comes in the form of, I'm assuming, a JPEG of this. So you can see these eyes. It's not bad. If I sketched that on my lunch break, I'd be relatively proud of myself, I think. That said, it's been a bit. It went on sale. And you know what? There were some bids. The opening bid was the equivalent of $250,000 in a SOL token. So that is a digital currency on, I believe it's called the Solana platform. Anyway, a portion of the proceeds were said to were going to be used to provide foster care children with access to computer science and technology education. In the end, it did go for 1,800 SOL, which is worth about $170,000 at that time. It's now 200,000, and then tomorrow it'll be worth $5, and then a million the next day. You never know. It's fun. But here's the thing about it. That might seem like mission accomplished. It sold for about what we thought it would, maybe not quite as much. But here's the thing. According to blockchain records reviewed by Motherboard, the person who bought the NFT collection appears to be Melania Trump, or at least whoever set up the auction for her. The winner of Melania Trump's NFT got the money from none other than the creator of the NFT itself, and an address linked to the NFT creator got the money back. So, you know, it's an NFT, it's a blockchain thing. So I don't even know if you can know more than that about this, but David, that seems weird.
Look, this is the first time I've ever talked about NFTs. I think I've read about them. But so the whole concept to me sounds really strange. I mean, the idea that you get an original JPEG, an original digital copy of some piece of artwork or some film or video or photograph, whatever, fine. I guess if people want to have the original on their computer or whatever, good for them. But who among us hasn't voted for ourselves in an online poll or something where our own credibility is in the public domain? And so, okay, Melania feels like the bids are not high enough. She wants to make sure that the bid gets matches what the asking price was. If that makes her feel better about herself and her status in life, whatever. Maybe you can explain the NFT and also the whole blockchain thing to me as well, because I'm still stumped.
Yeah, I could try. I like the idea. So either she did it herself knowing, okay, I just want it to be this much and I'll buy it or whatever. Or maybe she thought, okay, I'll pump up the bids and then someone will outbid me. Oops, maybe not. I love the idea that everybody's just voting for themselves. Earlier in the show on our Twitch poll, like Louis Gohmert's like, no, I'm the dumbest. He's voting for himself. Maybe not. But anyway, so yes, the idea is that it is a system for tracking and verifying the ownership of digital goods. So primarily the way it's analogized is that you are not buying the image. I mean, you are, but that's freely available. It's literally in my production document right now. You're buying the digital receipt to it. I would go one step further and say, you're not buying that either. What you're buying is a speculative financial instrument purely available in digital form that needlessly has an image attached to it that nobody would want. I mean, after all, can we show the image one more time? Can we put that up? The Melania's vision or whatever, those eyes. So take a look at this. Do you want it? Would you give me $5 for it? If I had a 16 by 20 that I printed out, would you hand me a $5 bill for it? Would anyone?
I mean, I wouldn't, but then again, I mean, I guess the world that I sort of come from, you know, there were people who were confused when I was a kid and I was really into baseball cards. And I always wanted the original Honus Wagner baseball card that would be worth, you know, $500,000. Well, I got, you know, a copy of it and I could put the copy of it and it looked exactly the same on my wall or in my album. But one of them actually had a lot of value. The other one just had maybe some aesthetic value. So I guess I sort of get it. But again, there's something, you know, there's something a little bit more wholesome and understandable about kids and trading cards. We're talking now about grownups and blockchain and grownups wanting to own the speculative rights to digital property. Why? Just so they can say they have it? I don't get it.
Well, so that they can make money and some will. I mean, and there's so many different layers to the scam. So there's pump and dump, there's washing where they do lots of trades back and forth because some of the platforms artificially, like in the algorithm, generate hype for certain properties based on how many times have been traded back and forth. So they just game that system by trading it back and forth between two people. It's just a lot of issues like that. And I do like your baseball card analogy though, because I think for some people, it's actually very similar to baseball cards. I mean, with the difference being that with baseball card, you at least have a baseball card. Right. It is a desperation. When I was a kid and I would buy some Spawn comics, I hoped it would rapidly rise in value. Why? Because I had no other means to getting money. I was desperate, so that's what I did. And I just hoped it would go up for no reason that I could really define. I feel like there's actually quite a bit of that in NFTs.
Right, but you were a kid and you're an aficionado of comics, right? These are grown-ups who are not exactly, I don't know, experts on Melania's eyes or eyes in general. I mean, when you describe it, it makes me think about Elizabeth Warren and her plan to try to, and Bernie Sanders wanting to put a tax on all Wall Street transactions, because you are essentially people trading pieces of paper. The paper itself is just a piece of paper, but you attach some meaning to it, and who can trade the pieces of paper the most in the fastest or the best, they make the most money. Well, that doesn't do anything for our economy. That doesn't help the greater good. So maybe while we're talking about putting taxes on Wall Street, which we should, let's put some taxes on NFTs and people who want to trade pieces of paper or digital images. Fine, do it to your heart's content. But you're not a child. These are not baseball cards or comics. You're a grown up. So pay up.
Yeah, I'd rather have the comics, honestly, despite being a grown up. By the way, you just raised an interesting possibility. We've got this thing of Melania's eyes that obviously nobody watching this would want. What if we did one of Bernie's vision, just a close up of Bernie's like red old eyes? I would pay $100,000.
Or the photograph of Bernie, like the iconic photograph with him like at the inauguration looking like this. You know, I can see that. That could be a great fundraiser. And he already made it something of a fundraiser, right? With the gloves. Sure. Whoever would want to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars having the original digital copy of that photograph by whoever was taken. Sure. Maybe that would raise a lot of money. And maybe that's money that could go to help charity or whatever it is.
Totally.
But it's still a little bit weird.
Yeah. And by the way, as we say every time, and I hope that this will become baked into the conversation, I am not saying that with NFTs or blockchain, there is not any legitimate use for the underlying technology. I am saying that it is being used largely in a scammy fashion. It is being used for stuff that has nothing to do with, like, if there's actual artists who are using NFTs, like, to sell their real art, that people, that's a great use of it, but not Melania's vision. Anyway, with that said, our producer really wants to hear about these postal trucks, so I'm gonna move on to that now. Let's do it. Just last week, we talked about the controversial plan to kind of upgrade the Postal Service's trucks. We've shown you what they look like. Here's a photo of the new trucks. It's they went in a direction, I will say that. Okay, that's not actually it, but you can see here the duck-billed postal truck that they're going to be putting out. Anyway, the appearance is not the important part. The important part is that they're gonna be buying about 165,000 new trucks. Only about 10% of them will be electric. Some might be able to be converted to electric. No plan has been presented for when or how or at what cost they will do that. And with the AC running, it gets only like 0.4 mile per gallon more than the one that they used to use. And that's still less than 9 miles per gallon. But that's all baked in. That's all terrible. Here's a new detail of how intentionally terrible this is. According to its environmental review of the procurement of these new trucks, the new gas delivery trucks have a new curb weight of 5,560 pounds and a payload of 2,941 pounds for a combined vehicle weight of 8,501 pounds. That is almost double the weight of the current USPS delivery vehicle, the LLV. So what does that matter? Why would we care? I mean, sure, it's heavier, but what's the difference? It's not just heavier. It is exactly as heavy as it needs to be to screw everyone over, including the environment. So, generally speaking, cars have more stringent regulations than trucks, and so-called light duty trucks, which are often what most people call SUVs, pickup trucks, minivans, have more stringent regulations than heavy duty trucks. In other words, as you move up through these different classes of vehicles, you can pollute more and more. If the trucks, the new ones that are being built, were 0.01% lighter, they would have to probably, under the USPS's rules, be electrical to meet the proposed requirements. But they're not, they're a higher class, so they can pollute way more. So they are intentionally heavier so that they can then be worse for the environment. This is the loophole, David, that just frustrates me and so many people about the way the government works.
This is one of the most depressing things that I've heard, and I had to spend like hours going through Lauren Boebert tape earlier today. I mean,
that's true.
These trucks are ugly, right? I've seen them, you know, in the toy store with my kids. He wants to get a postal truck, and I'm like, okay, it's sort of this new postal truck. I never knew that, you know, only 10% were going to be electric. What's the point in having a design this bad if it's not electric? That's ridiculous. And oh, by the way, this was the whole reason that they got new postal trucks, was to be electric and to help environment and be part of the solution, not the problem. This is ridiculous.
Exactly. I say, take Louis DeJoy, force him into early retirement, give him one of these painted gold as a going away present. He can drive that around to his heart's content. The rest of us need something more environmentally conscious. That should not be too much to ask.
Yeah, make him drive a rickshaw. If he's around his retirement community and have it.
Fine, it's good exercise.
Yeah, something that forces him to think about it while he's huffing and puffing. This is an embarrassment. It's a shame. It's a colossal waste of money. And it goes to show just how corrupt the process is for government contracts at every level. It's the people who are most connected to their friends, the suppliers, the contractors. Mm-hmm. They're the ones who get the contracts, not the companies necessarily that are the best for the environment or the best for the greater good.
Other consumers, yeah. Well, unfortunately, David, that's all the time we have for you on the program. Thank you so much for joining us. Everyone, check out Rebel HQ. Lots of great work there by David. We got more coming up. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right
back. Thanks, John.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.